Life is full of awesome what ifs, and some not so much, like unexpected medical costs. That's why United Healthcare provides Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans to supplement your primary plan and help manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
MintMobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 531.24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow wherever you are. Tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
Breaking and entering, drunk and disorderly, law and order. A former prosecutor and a defence lawyer, not your typical pairing. And the result? Conversations about crime and punishment that are guaranteed to get you thinking.
Welcome to Justice Matters with Joe Crowley and Lizzie Green, a brand new weekly podcast. Our episodes are available on Apple Podcasts, Spotify and YouTube. Check out our Instagram for clips at Justice Matters Pod. Enjoy the episode. This episode contains descriptions of violence, including gun violence and execution-style killings. Listener discretion is advised. Hello, Lizzie.
Hello, Joe.
How are you?
I'm very well. How are you?
I am very well as well.
Good.
So one of our avid listeners, solicitor, James, I'll just say James. I won't say, I don't know if he wants me to say sermon. I didn't ask him, but he messaged me and asked if we could do an episode on Lawyer X and Gangland. I don't know whether he meant the Gangland War, which is at least an episode in itself.
Yes.
Or just Lawyer X, but they're so intertwined. I'm going to have a crack at sort of Lawyer X, but it's all often about Gangland as well.
References, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I have to say I don't know a lot of the detail of Lawyer X, so I am very keen to hear what you have to tell us.
Okay. I suppose like everybody, I knew the name Lawyer X and I knew that it was Nicola Gobbo. In fact, I knew that before it was officially published because I think everybody did because it was pretty obvious who it was, which will probably come out.
Might be defence circles because I didn't know.
Didn't you? Okay. So, but I didn't realise how incredibly complex the story is. And I had very little sympathy for Nicola Gobbo when I started into this research because as a defence lawyer, I was like, you have just broken one of the most important rules of, you know, sort of legal ethics.
Okay. So I think maybe you should just do like a little brief synopsis because there's probably people who aren't like, familiar. Yeah. Okay. Like what's a little summary?
Little summary. Well, Lawyer X was a defence lawyer working in Melbourne during a period, the Gangland Wars, and she represented, as I found out, basically everybody on all sides of the Gangland Wars, and was for some of that time an official informer, but for all of that time an unofficial informer to the Victorian police.
And little conflict there.
The conflicts of interest are mind-blowing when you sort of get into it.
Good. So we'll come back to that, but then also we talk about the Gangland.
So what is Gangland? All right. So some people date it from 1998, some people date it from 1999, but wherever you start it was a war between rival drug cartels played out on the streets of Melbourne where people were being assassinated and those people were involved in the drug industry. Mm-hmm. So they weren't your innocent bystanders. I don't think any innocent bystanders died. Some police were killed, but people were killed in public. And I remember thinking on a trip to Melbourne, oh, I better not sit at a sort of a cafe outside, which is the kind of thing you do on Lygon Street in Melbourne, which is such a beautiful spot to sit. You know, lest I be hit by stray bullets. When you actually look into it, they're all sort of professional hits. And
so was this Gangland War, that was the inspiration for the Underbelly series?
Correct, yeah. I think the Underbelly series starts with the Gangland War. And in fact, the Gangland War was still going on when those episodes aired.
Yes.
Yeah.
So, I mean, we were riveted to the Underbelly TV series, you know.
Yes.
I think they made an order that they couldn't be screened in Victoria.
Yes.
So other states could watch it, but Victorians couldn't. So the jurors wouldn't be influenced.
Yes.
Futile in our current, you know, technology
age.
Yeah,
just get on Netflix.
That's right. But, I was very much familiar with all of that.
They gave it was something like almost a decade after the rest of Australia had seen it that all of it was properly aired in Victoria.
Yes.
Which is a little funny nowadays with the internet.
But it was very confronting. I remember, I mean, we're going to be talking about some pretty brutal activities.
Yes.
And the Underbelly was really gritty and and gory.
Yes.
You know, so interesting. But when you think that it's real people that they were recounting the stories of, it is pretty horrendous.
Oh, just unbelievable when you sort of got into it. So 36 people die. They die over a period of 12 years, but, you know, you're looking at sort of three or four people a year.
Mm.
I think in the busiest year there were sort of six people.
Well,
you know,
it's just the cold-blooded
assassinated
in
their driveway.
In front of their kids.
Some were killed in front. Two of them were killed in front of their own children.
Yeah.
Yeah, just horrible. I mean, shot in their own home. But the amount of money that is changing hands, even though we're talking about, you know, 20 years ago, is just eye-watering sums.
Yeah.
Yeah. So.
All right. So there's your little intro.
Okay. That's my intro. So I might just go through our dramatis personae. So I'll just identify people so that later on when I talk about them, everyone knows who I'm talking about, hopefully.
Good.
So obviously Nicola Gobbo is our main star. So she, as I said, defence barrister. Of Italian background. I think both her parents were born in Italy, so she's first-generation Australian but speaks fluent Italian. And her uncle was a Supreme Court judge and governor of Victoria.
Really?
Yes.
Do we know how old was she when this all came to light?
Oh, okay. So she goes to the bar as a 25-year-old in 1998. The Royal Commission starts in 2018, but she's effectively stopped working as a barrister. It pretty much comes out 2012, 2013, 2014.
So was she like mid-40s at the time?
My maths isn't great.
I think around there.
She's 35 in 2008. She's 45 in 2018.
Yep.
So Melbourne Law School graduate. They probably won't want me to say that, but there it is.
Obviously. Everyone has some, you know, less than stellar.
Yes.
Yeah.
She was at university, I think, with Peter Credlin. I don't know if they were friends, but they're sort of the same vintage.
Right.
It was interesting. And she was the youngest barrister to enter the Victorian Bar at age 25 in 1998.
Really?
Yeah.
Seems unusual.
Yeah. I know a barrister in Queensland who was 21.
I was younger than 25.
Yeah. Anyway, I don't know. It's Melbourne for you.
Yeah.
All right. So let's go through some of the elements. So the big names that people have heard, Carl Williams, obviously one of the most famous names. So he is, I don't know how you describe him, a drug lord, drug kingpin.
Drug loser.
Okay. That's a bit harsh. He was obviously very successful in his chosen profession.
Okay. He's in prison and died there. So he's
did
not
die
that
in prison.
Successful.
Well, I suppose it depends how you measure success. Mm. So he worked with, I probably shouldn't say four, but I think Tony Mockbell was probably the bigger than Carl Williams, but they certainly worked together.
Well, and I think there was a power struggle.
Not between those two. So they were on the same side. So on the other side of that was the Moran family. Jason
Okay. Yes,
so I'll sort of talk about that. And there's a third side. This is a triangle. There was Mick Gatto. In fact, I don't pretend to actually understand all the machinations of all of this, because then there were other people who sort of I think you sort of had allegiances to certain families. And then there was the Mockbells effectively on one side and people had allegiances there. And then there was the Morans on the other side and people had allegiances there.
Right.
So Carl Williams, yes, works with Tony Mockbell. Some people say the start of the Gangland Wars is 1999 when Carl Williams is shot in Gladstone Park by Jason and Mark Moran. Doesn't die, survives.
Yes.
And it doesn't sound like your typical shooting. So apparently I think Jason said, that they should kill him. Mark said no. It was a dispute over, of all things, a piano, apparently. And so they just shot him in the stomach with a .22 caliber, which is a pretty small caliber. And he, not only does he not die, they all get in the car and drive him home. And it happens to be Carl Williams' 29th birthday. And his mother has made him a chocolate cake. So he eats chocolate cake. 5 hours after he's shot, he goes to hospital.
I was going to call you on saying he was just shot in the stomach, but after hearing that.
Isn't
that
unbelievable?
Not really a big deal by the sounds of it.
Well, it reminded me of Ronald Reagan. I don't know if you remember Ronald Reagan being shot.
No, I know who he is, but.
He was shot on unsuccessful.
Like an assassination
attempt. Yeah. And one of the big things that we all talked about was the fact that he walked himself into the hospital. We're like, oh my God, this is amazing. He walks himself into the hospital. I don't know whether that's apocryphal or not, but that's certainly what people were saying at the time.
Sounds like it can happen.
Well, there's another story. Teddy Roosevelt, former American president. In 1912, he's giving a stump speech. So he's standing there speaking to the crowd and somebody in one of the front rows shoots him. And it goes through his 50-page speech that he was holding. That would have been, yeah. Anyway, through the speech.
It's probably why he got shot.
It's just so boring. It's a terrible thing to say. It hits, it goes into his chest, but it goes through his glasses case or something, into his chest. He falls down. They grab the shooter. He then gets up again.
Don't tell me he finished the speech.
He finished the speech.
No way.
50 minutes.
Oh, my goodness. Yes.
Well, he was a war veteran, so he'd been in the American-Cuban War.
He really wanted to say that speech.
Well, he figured that it had gone into his chest. He wasn't spitting blood, so he thought, well, it hasn't gone into my lungs, so I'm just going to keep going. When they get him to the hospital, they go, we're not removing the bullet. We're just, he had it in his chest for the rest of his life.
Wow.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, that is commitment to,
commitment to the
position.
Yeah. So, coming back to Carl Williams, he's shot, doesn't die. Unfortunately then, understandably, he bears an incredible grudge against the Moran brothers.
Oh, it's just and, a mere flesh wound.
And is implicated in their subsequent assassinations.
Right.
So that's Carl Williams. I'll do the Morans since I've talked about them. So they were the sons of Louis Moran. Actually, yeah, I think that's right. Or maybe one of them was a nephew. Anyway, they're related. They're part of the Moran clan. And the Moran clan, I understand, again, I'm not an expert, had sort of inherited a corrupt, you know, system of drug importation that had come through the Painters and Dockers Union that controlled the docks in Melbourne.
Oh, okay.
So Louis Moran was a member of that union. And, that, you know, I don't know when the union sort of, I don't
turned
know.
A blind eye or...
Oh, no, I think they were actively involved in corruption in the 50s, 60s. Oh. Anyway, it morphs into the Moran family who run this drug kingdom. By the end of the gangland wars, Jason, Mark, their father Lewis, and their uncle Des are all dead. They're all victims that get assassinated.
And look, they're human beings, but I have such an aversion to drugs, I kind of think, oh, well.
Well, you know, that idea of, oh, well, I mean, I think there's something in that to this extent. I'm not pretend to buy into it morally, but I think the people in Victoria were like, well, if these people want to kill each other.
Let them,
just don't do it on our streets.
And I think let's get rid of all the drug dealers.
Yeah, okay. I mean, but I mean, that attitude of, well, the victims are all really just drug dealers. Why do we care so much? That, I mean, I think that is an undercurrent of so much of what later happens and what pans out in terms of Nicola Gobbo and her incredible breach of legal ethics and law and the police who worked with her and what they did.
Mm.
You know, that idea of honourable cause corruption, the end justifies the means. We are putting bad people away, therefore it doesn't matter how we do it.
Yeah, I mean, I'm definitely not advocating murder, but it does not engender the same kind of outrage or horror that other victims do.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, I mean, I completely agree. So then our other big drug kingpins, Tony Mockbell is the other one. Again, his family, so he's got just some brothers and they're involved in the other side of the gangland war, and he works with Carl Williams, and he is most famous for his escape from Australia. So just towards the end of a big drug trafficking trial, he disappears. He's on the run for a couple of years. They find him in Greece. He gets extradited back. And when he's in Greece, he happens to be wearing a wig and cap or something, and so they make all these jokes about him.
Yeah.
Anyway, so he gets extradited back to Australia. He's still alive and in jail. Mick Gatto was the other one, and Mick Gatto, I should say, has always maintained he wasn't involved in illegal activity.
Oh, really?
Yeah, and I don't think he's ever been successfully prosecuted for anything big. He's out and living in the community. Really? He wrote a book, I'm Mick Gatto. You can read that.
Wow.
And interestingly, he was involved in, I didn't check whether they count this as one of the gangland victims, but he was involved in a shooting in a restaurant where he was charged with the murder but successfully argued self-defense because they were wrestling over the gun.
When it went off.
When it went off. And the victim, who I think was another drug kingpin or hitman or something.
So they must have been able to.
Well, I mean, it went before a jury and a jury believed he was acting in self-defense.
Wow. Was he charismatic?
I think so. He's a former boxer.
Mm-hmm.
I think all of these people are charismatic. I mean, I think when you look at them, I mean, provided they're not going to take guns or shoot you, or, you know, I'd probably have a beer with a few of them.
Oh, well, no offense, I think that'd be to Carl fun Williams, to have a beer with. But he was not the most attractive.
By the time he died, you're referring to he was known as Fat Boy.
Well, I think even before that, I think the Morans maybe were
attractive. I did not think this episode was going to take that.
Sorry, no. And it's completely irrelevant.
Okay.
I just wondered if
I
the jury.
I can't believe you're objectifying these men.
I wondered if the terrible. Jury acquitted him because he was charismatic. Yes.
Well, I mean, maybe charismatic people may well be, you know, they should do a study on it.
I do remember when I was a judge's associate and there was a guy who was my age who was charged with an armed robbery, and I remember his name, but I'll just say his first name. It was Bo.
Ooh.
And I can remember going out to judge's chambers and saying to my judge, seriously, I don't think he did it. He's so good looking. And he's like, Liz, that's got nothing to do with it. I'm like, oh, I can't believe it.
Come on,
it.
Please.
Yeah.
Yeah, interesting. Well, they did do a survey. I don't know if you tell your students about this one. And they, I think it was with mock juries and people, and they worked out that people who were overweight got convicted more than people who weren't.
That is actually disgusting, but I'll have to look that up.
Yeah.
Interesting.
All right, so Mick Gatto, so he's alive and well and living in the community as far as I'm aware.
Okay.
Tony McBell. Paul Dale is somebody who I'm going to talk about. I'm trying to limit the number of names. There's so many names, it's hard to keep across. But I am going to talk about a guy, Paul Dale. Now, I'm going to start by saying he has never been prosecuted. Sorry, he's never been convicted of any offences.
Okay.
He has been unsuccessfully prosecuted a couple of times. He was a police officer working in the drug squad during this time. He becomes involved in some of the stories that I'm going to talk about, one particularly in relation to the Hodson, Terry Hodson and his wife, Christine, which I think, well, I think everyone thinks is eventually leads to Nicola Gobbo's undoing.
Right.
So when I tell the stories, if I forget to remind everybody that he's never been convicted of anything, you can take it as a given, that I will be giving Terry Hodson's version of events, even though Terry's now deceased, because Terry gave long interviews to police and described what he said Paul Dale was doing. So the accusation is that he's a crooked cop.
But so we're just going to be allegedly.
I'll try and throw a few allegedlies in there. But as
the acknowledgement.
Yes, and he wrote his own book as well, Disgraced? So obviously the punctuation is very important in that title. I think it was a rhetorical question.
Oh, sure.
All right, so we've talked about the gangland wars, and as I say, some people say it started in 1998 with some other murders, but most people judge it from
the Carl Williams
shooting.
Carl
Williams being unsuccessfully killed, although apparently they weren't trying to kill him. Everybody agrees on the end date, and that is when Carl Williams is killed in jail in 2010. Okay, so he's in jail, and for reasons that I will explain, he is bashed to death by another inmate.
And so what, that was the final straw? That was violence too far? Why did it end there?
I think the agent provocateur in it all was Carl Williams. I have heard some people say that, you know, the rules of gangland and how it worked and, you know, who you killed, that Carl Williams broke those rules, particularly I think with the killing of Jason Moran and Paul Pasquale, who were I'll talk about their executions in a minute. And so my take, or what I understand, is that he was somebody who had really broken those gangland rules about when you kill people, how you kill people. You know, you don't do it in front of their family, and you don't do it in public. And he'd sort of thrown that rule book out the window and just was
gone rogue.
And so when he died,
they drew a line under it.
Well, yeah, everyone had been paid back, I suppose.
Right. Oh, well, good.
So Nicola Gobbo, as I said, she is an official informer, as informer 3838 from I think it's 2004, 2005. And thinking about my gangland timeline, that is really almost halfway through. So she said, and the police often said, difficult times, you know, need extraordinary measures as their justification for using a defense lawyer as their informant. And some of her justifications were, I just couldn't, you know, morally live with myself defending these people, and so I was helping to put them away.
So do we need to just clarify why it's so extraordinary that a defense barrister would be an informant?
Yes, absolutely.
Would you ever be an informant?
I would never, ever be a police informant, except in the very limited circumstances. So perhaps I should just say legal professional privilege is the biggest thing that she breached, which is the a special evidentiary rule which applies to information told to lawyers in circumstances where they're working as your lawyer. I won't go into the details of the actual rule, but if they're working as you, as your lawyer, and the client tells them things, that's covered by legal professional privilege, so that it can't be used, or it's very difficult for it to be used as evidence in court,
or disclosed,
by the lawyer
to anyone,
or people are listening in,
yeah.
So there is actually an exception to that, and that is if you know as a lawyer. If your client tells you that a criminal offence is going to happen, then you could validly then go and tell the police that, because that wouldn't be covered by legal professional privilege, because it won't cover illegality.
Is that the same as a confession to a priest?
Yes, I think that's right.
Yeah.
I think there's confessions to a priest, although now don't priests have an obligation to disclose confessions about child sex matters?
Oh, probably that. But yeah. I think if you confessed that you were going to do something, that was the only time they could sanctity of the confessional.
Yes. Well, interestingly, I mean, the common law grows out of, church law. Mm. And so I think there really is a parallel. Although I know journalists hate legal professional privilege, because journalists have a sort of privilege, journalistic privilege, which, where if an informer tells them something and they don't want to reveal their source, they
don't have to. Well,
they sort of do have to. They often claim it and courts just ignore it.
Right.
And some journalists have gone to jail for not revealing their sources. And so I have heard journalists complain about lawyers protecting other lawyers with the legal professional privilege, because obviously judges who decide these things are themselves former lawyers.
Yeah.
But, I mean, the point of it is so that people are honest and open with their lawyers.
But so is that the biggest reason it's so unusual that she would be an informant?
Yes, that is the biggest, I think. The other problem that she had was a conflict of interest.
Okay.
So that she would, so conflict of interest, if you are representing a client and you have to do your best you can for that client and what is ever in that client's best interest. Mm-hmm. So if you are then representing another client and that your two clients' interests clash,
right,
you then can't represent both of them. You have to jettison one, yes, and stay with another.
So who is more typically a police informant?
Typically, police informants are, there'll be other police informants in this story, and they are other criminals.
Right.
I can't believe as a prosecutor you never worked on cases with police informants.
I'm asking for people who don't know.
Right. That's okay. So I have worked on cases where there's been police informants. Often they don't say, a police informant told us, blah, blah. You just, it's just like, police received information and raided a house, and you're like, yes, where did that information come from?
Yes, yes. And so, we used to have to be very careful about information provided and questions about what is their criminal history and what's their reliability record.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, it's interesting what a big part of policing it was. I don't know normally, but certainly in the gangland, it wasn't just Nicola Gobbo who was informing. There was another solicitor who was, or she was a barrister, sorry. There was a solicitor who was also informing.
Did she get in trouble?
He.
Oh, he.
Honestly, you're so sexist sometimes. when you say did he get in trouble, well, he was assassinated, so I'd say so. Okay. Yeah. Then who else? Then the other people who are informing are all of these people who are working in the different factions.
Gun
trafficking, yeah. And they're informing on each other. And
wow, so she was with some dicey company.
Unbelievable. Mm. But one of the other issues I just wanted to tease out in terms of law is this idea of conflict of interest. So as an informer, if you are telling the police everything, you know, then your interests in terms of talking to the police conflict with your client's interests of getting sound legal advice that's best for them.
Yes.
And there are a number of occasions where she put pressure on people to plead guilty because it was better for police and, in fact, roll on their co-accused.
Yeah.
So she certainly in this book, I'm holding up to the camera for those watching on YouTube, Lawyer X by Anthony Dowsley and Patrick Carline, which I certainly can recommend, suggests that she is instrumental in convincing a number of really well-placed people in the drug, you know, trafficking industry to inform on other people. So then that obviously raises questions later on about she's not in because she's acting for that person who she then convinces to turn state's evidence, as it was.
Yes.
One
more question.
You're right.
Was she being paid by the police?
No. So she does get a payout when she sues the police years later, but she is not being paid by the police for.
So why do it?
Well, I must say I think that it's a personality thing. I mean, like people who get involved in the drug trade and live this existence, which I just couldn't
do fraught.
For 5 minutes. Yeah. It's just so dangerous and whatever. But anyway, they obviously get off on the adrenaline or whatever. I don't know. Certainly the money, that's just a lot of money. She was living that life as well. I mean, she has such inappropriate relationships with all of these people, including sexual relationships with some of them.
It just seems so unnecessarily complex.
Oh, I agree. I mean, there's stories that she was constantly on her phone, constantly phoning people. I just couldn't deal with that. Like,
she have a family?
She didn't have a partner. She eventually falls pregnant and has two children, but she's never married.
Right.
She has a family. She has some sisters. Her father dies when she was in year 12, but she was close to her mother. Her mother died, you know, when she was, what, in a sort of late 30s, and she had a close relationship certainly with one of her sisters.
Okay.
But not close enough, I think, that they knew that she was doing this.
You couldn't be telling people.
No.
No. All right. Ah, oh, I'm already invested in this. We haven't even really started.
Okay. All right, good. All right. So let's jump back to the start. So she finishes school. She's a prefect. She's a house captain. She's very popular. But a bit of a party girl, but gets a good enough grades, I think, to scrape into Melbourne Uni Law.
Right.
And then at law school, she continues to be a party girl. She just cruises through her law degree. She doesn't set the world on fire, but
P's get degrees.
P's get degrees. Mm. That's right. Passes for those who are not. Passes get degrees. But she first informs, if you like, in 1993 when she is a law student.
Ah.
And she is living in a house with a guy who I think they're in a sort of a friends with benefits type relationship, but they co-owned the house. I mean,
wow.
Yeah, credit to her for buying property young.
Gosh.
So they have a mortgage and they're splitting the mortgage. He is a drug trafficker. So the police raid the house one day. They find a 20-gallon drum in the middle of the lounge room full of marijuana.
Holy moly.
Yeah. She's not at the house at the time. He is. They arrest him. She then comes through the door an hour or so later. They immediately grab her, take her to a separate room. This is all standard practice in searches and search warrant executions, as you know. Take her to a separate room. Obviously, start putting the pressure on her. You're in trouble. You live in the house. You know, drugs have been found in the house. You know, prima facie, on the face of it, you know the drugs are here. We're going to charge you with possession.
Because more than one person can be in possession.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
When it comes to your finances, you think you've done it all. You've saved, you've researched, and you've invested all that you can. Now it's time to take those investments to the next level by using the brand behind every great investor, Yahoo Finance. As America's number one finance destination, Yahoo Finance has everything you need, whether you're a seasoned trader or just dipping your toes into the market. Join the millions of investors who trust Yahoo Finance to guide them on their financial journey. For comprehensive financial news and analysis, visit yahoofinance.com, the number one financial destination, yahoofinance.com.
Possession of the drugs, they can both be charged.
So she's a law student. She's concerned exactly what happens. I think one of the police says, she then says, how about I point out where some real drugs are?
Oh.
And so that she takes them to something that overlooked in the search inside some vent somewhere. It's like 1.3 kilos of amphetamines.
Wow.
Yeah. So she is charged with, I think, possession or something like that. But the prosecution go easy on her. She gets effectively a slap on the wrist and allowed to go. He goes to jail. He doesn't know that she has
told them.
So when he gets out a couple of years later, he moves back into the house.
Oh, gosh.
She said the reason she did it was to get him out of her life. They were sort of dating, not dating. She didn't want him around. It was complicated, whatever. On her application to become a lawyer, she has to disclose, obviously, this conviction.
Mm.
But she says she didn't know there were any drugs in the house. So obviously she didn't tell the legal admissions board that there
told them.
She said she didn't know he was a drug taker, didn't know there were drugs in the house.
So how did she know to show them where the...
Well, that didn't come out. It didn't come out that she'd dogged on her housemate.
She's dodgy from the start.
Well, that's what... all this comes out in the Royal Commission.
Yeah.
You know, in the 2019-2020. Anyway, so she then goes on, finishes her law degree, gets admitted, starts to work as a solicitor, gets a job at a solicitor's firm. I think she starts originally in commercial law, finds it pretty boring. Mm. We can all understand why that is, yep. Wants to do criminal law, gets a job in a criminal law firm and really thrives. And
she's with her people.
Yeah, super energetic and she's in court all the time. I mean, as you know, it's very different from commercial law because you are in court all the time. And it's often sort of high stress, high stakes of people going to jail, often media involved. So, you know, there is, I can see the attraction with
and,
it.
And, you know, with respect to victims, it is super interesting.
Mm.
You know, what people will do will never fail to boggle the mind.
Yeah. So she is enjoying that and doing very well. Now, at that time, she then becomes an informer again. Because she goes to court, and this is how I think she gets away with it for so long. Because you go to court so often and the police are at the court because they're the witnesses or the investigating detectives, you know, she's talking to police at court all the time. So she knows them all. And so she can say to them, listen, I think my boss, she informs on her own boss.
What?
I think he's laundering money. You should investigate
him. Is she just an attention seeker?
I think there is a bit of that, yeah.
Like that is just, I mean, obviously she's not ethical because she pretty much lied to the admissions board.
Yes.
And even before that, she lied to her housemate. You know, like she's, I don't think ethics is an issue for her.
No.
This is next level.
Mm. Seeking out the police too. So the Victorian police often claimed, oh, she sought us out to tell us stuff. She says, No, they harassed me to talk to them.
Who do we believe?
It's hard to know.
I would believe the police.
maybe not after you hear some of the things.
All right.
So they do investigate her employer, like a two-year investigation into, which he doesn't even know is going on.
Oh, my God.
They find nothing. He doesn't know about it until the Royal Commission.
So he wasn't laundering?
No.
So what? That is bizarre to me. She was after attention, surely.
I don't know.
Making a big note of herself.
I don't know.
Is that the phrase?
Anyway, she decides she wants to be a barrister. So that means that she's going to be in court more, wear the wig and robes, and do arguing of more serious cases rather than just the sort of the magistrate's court, minor court stuff that solicitors tend to do. As I said, she goes to bar 25. She's the youngest female barrister. And she immediately sort of starts to have success. She's obviously has an ability. Her first employer, who she ratted on, said that she was an incredibly hard worker and would, you know, do these fantastic case briefs, you know, summarising cases,
yeah,
and ability to read a brief quickly and find the weaknesses in the prosecution case. And she's obviously very good, and she starts to make a name for herself quite quickly, particularly on bail. She seems to have a real knack at getting people bail. And so she comes to the attention of some of the big wig drug kingpins.
Who want bail.
Manages to get them bail. And, you know, but the amazing thing is she's working for both sides. She is the lawyer for the Morans. She is the lawyer for Mock Bell.
Why would they be okay with that?
They're not okay with it. I mean, I should say this. In some sense, as a lawyer, you are a gun for hire. If somebody wants you to represent them, they pay you, you represent them. If it's an area in which you practice and it's the fee is acceptable to you, you have an obligation to take it, the cab rank rule. But not where there's a conflict of interest.
Yeah, that's the reason you can say no.
Yes, it's one of the big reasons you can say no. The problem is with conflict of interest is each lawyer is responsible to determine their own conflicts. And they say for themselves, well, I can't take this because it's a conflict. So in some sense, it's sort of self-policing.
Yes.
And you can be disciplined for it ethically if something blows up, you know, that you should have known and you didn't.
What, by the barrister's board? Or?
Yeah, but that's the thing. How do these things blow up? And what tends to happen is it becomes an issue in court because the other side say, well, hang on, you can't represent that person because you are conflicted.
Yes.
And so the other side complains about it. And then you have a hearing in court about whether you are conflicted. And sometimes courts have said, yes, you are conflicted, and lawyers have been not allowed to represent a particular person. But if the other side's not complaining.
Or if they don't know.
Well, I mean, the other side in her defence cases are the prosecution who, I mean, the actual prosecutors might know, but the police are obviously not going to be raising any conflicts.
Yeah.
And if you're representing the Mock Bells, you know, or Mock Bell associates, the Morans can't complain because they're not a party to the proceeding.
Yes.
So that's why it goes, nobody, it seems, ever complained of a conflict of interest.
But so that's coming straight back to the ethics again.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, the problem is the people who knew it was a conflict of interest were the police when she became an informer, because they knew that her interests now on working for them and informing conflicted with her client's interests.
Right. So they also are.
Well, when they say to her, listen, see if you can get this guy to roll, and she gets this guy to roll, she's not advising the client.
No, she's not acting for them.
Yeah.
Yes. Ooh, it's very murky, isn't it?
So unbelievably murky.
Yeah.
So
defense lawyers, you can't trust them.
Yeah, I know. So Mark Moran.
No
so,
bite?
Buy into that. So 1999 is when Jason and Mark Moran shoot and wound Carl Williams.
Fat boy
Williams.
Gosh, but you don't find attractive. Disrespectful.
You don't find attractive. I know. You can't speak ill of the dead.
You can.
Mark Moran, who's only 36 at the time, he's shot dead while getting out of his car. He pulls up in his driveway. Professional hit. Someone shoots.
What year is this?
This is 2000. Okay. June 2000. September 2002, Gobbo is representing Mock Bell, the Moran's arch nemesis, gets him bail, $1 million surety.
Wow.
Manages to get him bail. He's on very serious drug charges. I thought you'd like this. She actually represented on two occasions women who had killed their husbands. So this is not related to the gangland, but I thought you might be interested. she represents Maria Gadzovic, who was tried for manslaughter for killing her husband of 50 years, who had been abusive to her. She killed him with a saucepan and a walking stick. She is convicted and released on an undertaking.
What year was that?
2002, December 2002.
And see, that would have been probably before all of the deeper understanding of battered wife syndrome.
I think Secretary was the late 90s, wasn't it? The case that sort of sets
up. But it would have been quite in its infancy. We certainly have, you would hope, a lot more understanding now of the psyche of an abused person.
Yeah.
Oh, my gosh.
But I know you're interested in the range of sentences you can get in manslaughter. There's another crazy one, isn't it?
I mean, not that I oppose, but then I think so. Well, anyway, different story. But then why have the conviction? It does, you know, it makes a bit of a mockery. Like, you've killed someone, but we'll just give you the good behaviour bond.
Slap on the wrist.
Yeah. Anyway.
So what the police often do at this time, so she's not an official informer at this time. She had been an official informer earlier on. She hasn't gone back to officially being informed, but she's constantly.
So what's the difference?
Well, officially you're registered with them and you get a number.
Sort of like they've verified you? As in, like, what? Well, I don't understand.
I suppose. I don't know. I mean, as soon as you were registered, there was a police informers unit. Or there's a unit of police. You have a police handler. There's a whole lot of protocols that the police are supposed to follow with you.
Does some informants get paid?
I don't know, but
just
do it out of the goodness of their
heart. Otherwise, why be registered?
Yeah.
It's not like you're going to get sick leave and holiday pay, you know.
I think because you can get protection and you can be put into witness protection.
Oh, it's
one
okay.
of the big issues is later on the police are saying to Nicola Gobby, you need to go into witness protection. She says no.
Right.
So, but they do give a sort of a special tactical unit protection for her at a particular period when she's...
Okay, no, that makes more sense. Yeah. All right, good.
But what the police are doing is somebody will get arrested, taken to the watch house. They'll say, I want a lawyer. And the police will go, oh, call Nicola Gobbo.
Oh, my goodness.
But I have seen this so often that the police recommend solicitors for people to use because somebody is arrested, they go to jail, they go, I don't know a lawyer. And the police are like, here, use so-and-so.
I thought they weren't meant to do that.
Well, I've seen it a lot, a lot. And I am not a fan because often I'm picking up the work after that and then I see the advice they're given at the police station. I'm like, why did you ever do that? And they're like, oh, the police told me to call so-and-so. I was like, oh, my God.
But see, the police can't win because then we've also had cases where they've said, I don't know any lawyers, so they'll give them the
phone book. Well, but why not? Just hand it. I mean, we don't have phone books nowadays.
No, I know, but, you know, and they're like, that's not enough. You know, like that was the case of Benton. They said that in that case. They said it wasn't, you know, they weren't really helpful.
Here's a phone book. Well, I think that's fine. I mean, I've seen the other thing I've heard is that police will say, somebody will be arrested in the watch house. They'll say, get me a phone. I want to call, you know, Joe Bloggs, my lawyer. And they go, oh, you can't use Joe Bloggs. He's already representing somebody else. He's conflicted out. And so they'll tell you, the police will tell you somebody's conflicted and dissuade you from using a lawyer.
But if that's true.
It's not for the police to decide. I explained how conflict of interest works. It's for the lawyer themselves or for a matter to be raised in court. It's got nothing to do. If the police want to raise it, they can raise it in court. The problem is they're dealing with unlettered people mostly who are, you know, in the watch house.
But is it conceivable that sometimes that advice of the police is to save that person time?
Is it conceivable?
Yes.
Is there an alternative universe in which the police might be giving advice which is helpful to the accused person?
Just because there may be some police you don't agree with doesn't mean they all have nefarious motives and are not doing things for the right reasons.
Well, sorry, when you say nefarious motives, I mean they're presumably motivated by doing their job, which is to arrest guilty people, make a case against them and have them convicted.
No, but I like the people who are recommending Nicola Gobbo to prisoners, I would worry about their reasons. But I would think most police, if they say, oh, you shouldn't call him because he's conflicted, are doing it for the sake of the, oh.
Not as far as I can see.
You're very harsh on our police.
All right. So what do we get to? What I really wanted to talk about was two things. It was the world's largest ecstasy haul.
Wow. The world's largest.
At the time.
Yeah.
The world's largest ecstasy haul.
The things we're famous for.
I don't think it is anymore. This was in 2004. Mm-hmm. I think some other country has beaten us. But I'll come back to it. I really wanted to talk about the incident that effectively begins the beginning of the end for Nicola Gobbo. And it's a complicated one.
All right.
So it's the execution murder of a man called Terence Hodson and his wife, Christine. Now, Terence is a low-level drug dealer, okay? So he is in the Mokbel Carl Williams camp and he is, dealing drugs.
Right.
But he's just a small suburban dealer. His whole family's in on it. His kids deal drugs. In fact, their family gatherings seem to be
there. Does the wife?
I think she was a housewife. I don't want to say just a housewife. I think she was a housewife. I think she knew what was going on. They used to all sit around the table and snort coke at family functions.
Oh, that's so lovely. Family who do drugs together.
So Terry Hodson, in 2001, he gets upset because his daughter is picked up by the police and charged with possession of amphetamines. And despite the fact that he was the one who gave her amphetamines, Terry is upset that his daughter might go to jail. I mean, I'm not sure what he thought would happen when they would be snorting coke at Christmas. And anyway, so he, in 2001, becomes a police informer.
Ah.
But let me throw into the mix at least one crooked cop. So there was a guy from the drug squad, Michelle, who's his surname, was absolutely crooked. He worked with Paul Dale, who, as I said before, has never been convicted of anything and denies any wrongdoing.
Also a police officer.
So they are the police drug squad people and they are involved with Terry Hodson. But Hodson says that they are in fact involved in his drug operation and so that they will, skim the money off the top. More than that. I mean, for example, there was one occasion where they gave him money to buy drugs for a drug sting.
Allegedly.
They make the sting. They arrest the other people. They don't arrest Terry Hodson. And then the drugs that he bought, they allow him to sell at a profit. And he doesn't go to jail for this entire period. So they know he's dealing drugs and they let him deal drugs.
Okay. That is very problematic.
Yes. So it gets even more murky. So Nicola Gobbo knows all of these people and has acted for Andrew Hodson, the son, when he was charged with offences, and so knows Terry.
They're not good criminals.
Knows Tony Mokbel, who she's represented, who she's got out on bail for $1 million.
Yeah.
Knows Carl Williams. Knows Paul Dale, the police officer, and I'm not exactly sure when it starts, but is in a relationship, a sexual relationship with Paul Dale.
Wow.
The crooked police officer, Michelle, who is, tasked with investigating and being a handler for Terry Hodson, the informer.
Yeah.
He's sleeping with Hodson's daughter.
Oh, my Lord.
Yeah.
And did Michelle know that Gobbo and Dale were...
I don't know. Mm. So Gobbo, I think, says they only actually slept together once.
Bull.
Yeah, I think based on their messaging and texting.
I think we can't really believe a lot of her assertions. I'm feeling like that at this stage in the
Well,
tale.
I think you're in good company. I think the Honourable Margaret McMurdo, who ran the Royal Commission into this.
I love that it was her that did that.
Felt the same.
Yeah.
So it gets even more murky because it all sort of starts to come unravelled when crooked police officer Michelle accused crooked police officer Paul Dale and Terry Hodson, drug trafficker and informant, all decide to rob one of Tony Mokbel's drug houses. So they know where the drug house is because Nicola Gobbo has told them.
Oh, my goodness.
They decide, so they're effectively robbing their own side, as it were, because Terry Hodson works for...
Yeah, he's in part of the chain.
Yeah. So they decide.
See, this is why you don't do drugs, because your brain is fried. The stupidity of this.
Wow. I mean, it's pretty stupid, but then it's not too fried because this is such a complex story. I'm struggling to follow it.
But to think that is a good idea. I mean, to do the drugs and deal them is also not a good idea, but you're not thinking straight.
No, sure. But, I mean, $750,000 in cash.
Greed.
They get from this. Anyway, so they decide that they know where the drug house is. They decide they're going to rob it. They rob it on grand final night, AFL grand final night, which is in September 2003. Paul Dale, this is Terry Hodson's version, says, I'm not coming. I've got people at home. We're entertaining or something. Though, so Michelle, the crooked cop, and Hodson, Terry Hodson himself, decide to do it themselves.
Right.
So
Gobbo's not part of the plan?
No. So she
just gave the information.
She gave the information.
Okay. Knowing that they were going to do this?
No, I think she'd given it some time earlier.
Okay.
She seemed to give lots of information to lots of people and really exactly what her motives were.
She wanted the attention.
It gets even worse because the drug squad who Paul Dale and Michelle worked for were looking, you know, they had were surveilling the house.
Oh, my goodness.
The surveillance team just happened not to be there that night or were on a break or whatever. Surprise, surprise. There's a break-in. It's the most ham-fisted break-in. They literally bash the door down. They smash the front light and bash the door down. So what do you reckon happens? The neighbors hear and call the police.
Oh, my God.
They get in, run around the house, grab bags of drugs, grab money, come out, throw the money over the back fence and then disappear and get away.
They are masterminds.
Masterminds. They then wait a little while and go back. The problem is by the time they go back, the police are around and they get chased by a police dog and one of them gets bitten. Michelle gets bitten by a police dog.
It. Yeah.
Well, so badly that he had a limp for the rest of his life.
That's okay.
Wow, that's rough. Okay.
Dog did his job.
Okay. I've got issues with use of police dogs, but anyway.
Oh, I don't.
Okay. I've seen some pretty horrible injuries from police dogs.
Well, don't run from police.
Well, it's not. They're not allowed to shoot you from running from them. I don't know why they can sool a dog onto you. I mean, the injuries are pretty. I mean, I know a guy who can't use his hand anymore because his arm was just so badly torn up.
What offense did he commit?
I don't know. He was a drug guy.
Yeah.
I can't remember.
You get what's coming for you.
Okay, so they get caught. So those two get caught on the night. The crooked cop Michelle and Terry Hodson get caught on the night, and are taken to the police station
without the gear. Had they?
The
up.
Money is never found again. $750,000 in cash. It's amazing how much just cash is just lying around. And
what do you mean? $750,000 went missing?
Goes missing.
And nobody?
I don't know. Well, in this fantastic book by Dowsley and Patrick Carlin, they say it just is missing. It's not found. So
that is, I want to find the money.
I don't think it's, you know, like some lost treasure.
Like, did the police?
Well, part of the problem was there was this corrupt cop, you know, this real worry that there were corrupt cops in the police force,
yeah,
which, as it turned out, there were.
Well, I mean, if there are two in the drug squad,
were
there more? And did they find the $750,000 when they went back?
Well, so Michelle doesn't rat out Paul Dale, assuming Paul Dale's involved, which is only alleged.
Right.
Terry Hodson does.
I wonder if Paul Dale snuck in and got the gear.
Well, Paul Dale immediately on that night visits Michelle in hospital with his pretty savage dog bite, immediately goes to police headquarters, and it is alleged that at police headquarters he takes the file which had 31 information reports given by Terry Hodson against underworld figures. He takes that and leaves because that folder disappears and is never seen again.
Oh.
Well, sorry, when I say it's never seen again, it's picked up on police wiretaps being faxed from Tony Mockbell to a criminal associate in Queensland.
Gosh, this is very complicated.
It is, isn't it? But it is alleged that the way it gets to Tony Mockbell
is through
his lawyer, Nicola Gobbo. She's always denied that. But it's said that it's gone from Paul Dale, the man she's sleeping with,
yes,
to Tony Mockbell. So Terry Hodson says of himself, I'm a dead man walking. Okay, because he now, you know, has informed on Paul Dale.
Yeah,
I don't think he knows he's informed on Paul Dale. I don't think he knows that his, you know, the fact that he's been a police informer is out there.
But, well, he's caught with a police officer.
Yes, caught with a police, with a crooked police officer.
Yeah.
And so he says, I'm a dead man walking. And
was he?
He was a dead man walking. Why don't I briefly tell you what happens to him, and then we might have to leave it there for our next episode.
Oh, my gosh. All right, yes, that's too big a cliffhanger. Tell us what happened to Terry and then we'll...
So that's September 2003 is this ham-fisted, break-in. Break-in. It's not until May 2004 or early 2004 when they're all charged. So Paul Dale is charged, this Michelle bloke's charged, and Terry Hodson are all charged with the break-in.
So Dale's charged on the basis of Terry's evidence.
Correct.
Okay.
So, and Paul Dale is put in jail and is visited in jail by Nicola Gobbo, his lawyer, who is also representing Terry Hodson.
No.
Yes.
But how can someone not And who is also working
for Tony Mockbell, who, although isn't charged, it's in his interest to, you know.
Okay, but you say it's got to be self-determined conflict.
Well, in first instance, yeah.
But for pity's sakes, how can anybody know that scenario and not say to her, love, you got a conflict there?
Oh, it's an even bigger conflict because the police then raid the drug house and they arrest all the people in the drug house. And Gobbo represents the three people that were in the drug house.
Holy moly.
Yeah.
What a mess.
Absolute mess.
I'm sure that wouldn't happen in Queensland.
Well, one of the things that's interesting is there's never been a broad-ranging inquiry into police corruption in Victoria. I mean, we in Queensland...
There never has.
Never has. We had, obviously, the Fitzgerald Inquiry in Queensland. They had the Woodraw Commission in New South Wales. There's never been a broad... There was an inquiry...
We just had Fitzgerald 2.0 as well.
And we had Fitzgerald 2.0 in the last couple of years, yeah. That was really into the Triple C, wasn't it?
I know, but still, peripherally...
I mean, I think that, every 30 years or so, they should just do a Royal Commission into police corruption because, you know, certainly they haven't done one in Victoria.
That's crazy.
There was one in 74, apparently, and it was into abortion clinics and corrupt cops being paid off to turn a blind eye to abortion clinics. 55.
Very specific?
They did an inquiry into it. 55 officers were recommended to be charged. 33 officers were charged. Guess how many were convicted?
Oh.
Zero.
What?
Zero officers convicted. Yeah. So that's the previous inquiry into an aspect of police corruption.
So I'm guessing maybe they're not having them in Victoria because pointless.
They don't like bad press. Well, the other thing that made the police very gun shy of Royal Commissions is the Ash Wednesday fires or the Black Saturday fires that occur around this time?
Yes.
There's a Royal Commission into them.
Yes.
And the response of the police officers to that was criticised.
Were they Black Saturday?
Black Saturday. Ash Wednesday. I can't remember.
I feel bad.
We have a lot of terrible bushfires in this country, which...
But anyway, so tell me...
Well, I think probably... why don't we leave it on a cliffhanger? Nobody knows what's going to happen to Terry Hodson and his wife, Christine, which is a bit sad because she obviously was a housewife and I'm not sure what her role in it all was. But why don't we come back next time? We'll talk about what happens to them and we'll talk about what happens and how it all
tumbles
sort of starts
down.
To come unstuck. It takes a long time because, I mean, we're in 2004... It's not written up in the paper. The term Lawyer X doesn't appear till 2014, 10 years later.
Wow.
The name of Nicola Gobbo is not released until, I think, 2019, and the Royal Commission's not until 2019, 2020.
Yeah. The wheels of justice move slowly.
But they do work. They do move, and they just grind people through them.
All right. Well, until next week.
Okay. Thanks, Lizzie.
Thanks, Joe.
Thanks for tuning into this episode. You can find links to the cases that we discussed in the description. You can also find a link to Guardian Criminal Law, and a big shout out to them for making this podcast possible.
The majority of criminal cases involve people, normal people, people like you, people like me, who find themselves in an unusual set of circumstances that would not usually occur in their life. My name's Mark Savick, and I'm here to assist you with your criminal matter. I look forward to hearing from you and being of assistance to you.
If you're interested in clips, you can look at them on Instagram and TikTok. Just search for Justice Matters Pod. See you next episode.
When it comes to your finances, you think you've done it all. You've saved, you've researched, and you've invested all that you can. Now it's time to take those investments to the next level by using the brand behind every great investor, Yahoo Finance.
As America's number one finance destination, Yahoo Finance has everything you need, whether you're a seasoned trader or just dipping your toes into the market. Join the millions of investors who trust Yahoo Finance to guide them on their financial journey. For comprehensive financial news and analysis, visit yahoofinance.com, the number one financial destination, yahoofinance.com.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
My business used to be weighed down by the complexities of in-person payments. Then, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe came along and changed everything. With Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe, I streamlined my payment process effortlessly. Now I can accept in-person, contactless payments right from my iPhone. No extra hardware required. What's truly remarkable is how I can cater to all of my customers' payment preferences. Whether they're using cards, Apple Pay, or other digital wallets, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe ensure a smooth checkout experience every time. And it's not just me. Stripe helps businesses of all sizes, from local markets to global retailers, scale quickly and stay agile. To learn how Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe can help grow your revenue and reach, visit stripe.com/tapiphone.